There will be no more low-income housing forced into the suburbs. It's been hell for suburbia.
There is another way, and we have imagined it. Our vision, a homes guarantee.
It adopts the tenets of the Green New Deal, which is first to center frontline communities, those who are impacted most by the climate crisis. That is communities that are low income, communities of color, native communities, rural communities. We're going to center them, and that's why we've decided to go with public housing first.
Under this plan, we will invest $70 billion to repair and expand our dilapidated public housing stock.
What are you going to do as president?
Well, I'm going to make sure that everyone qualifies for Section 8 housing. No one should pay more than 30% of their income. We have to invest a great deal of money. Housing should be a right for people.
With over 5.5 million cases and more than 175,000 deaths, the outbreak of COVID-19 in the United States is now by far the worst in the world. This unprecedented public health emergency has stopped the global economy in its tracks, sparking a downturn on a scale not seen since the Great Depression. In the last 6 months, the U.S. economy has seen its sharpest decline since records began, with over 57 million Americans filing for unemployment relief. Amidst the wreckage of this crash, America's housing crisis is more immediate and real than ever. As millions are laid off around the country, there is not a single U.S. state where the number of affordable homes to let matches the number of low-income people looking to rent. Where people can find shelter, three-quarters of all extremely low-income families pay more than half their income in rent. With eviction moratoriums now lifting across the country and Congress stalling over a new relief package, recent reports suggest that up to 43 million Americans could face eviction in the coming months. In part one of our documentary podcast on the U.S. housing crisis, we explored how racial discrimination is a foundational theme in the history of U.S. federal housing policy and examined the negligence of Trump's tenure in the context of decades of disinvestment and privatization by successive administrations. In part two, we'll consider the failure of existing policy frameworks to deal with the housing crisis and examine how popular movements are proposing radical new policies, reshaping the political discourse on housing in the midst of the 2020 U.S. election cycle.
Great to see you. Thank you for joining us again in Davos. We've done this before.
That's right.
I think it was a couple of years ago. Before we get started, we're going to talk about the economy, a lot of other things. The CDC has identified a case of coronavirus in Washington State, the Wuhan strain of this. If you remember SARS, that affected GDP, travel-related effects. Have you been briefed by the CDC?
I have.
Are the words about a pandemic at this point?
No, we're not at all, and we have it totally under control. It's one person coming in from China, and we have it under control. It's going to be just fine.
Even before the coronavirus hit, the U.S. housing crisis was one of the worst in the developed world. On any single night during 2019, over 500,000 Americans were without a home. Nearly 200,000 people slept rough on the nation's streets. In the face of this humanitarian crisis, the existing policy frameworks have fallen woefully short. The Section 8 system for housing vouchers is still the major program tasked with providing shelter to tenants in a chronically unaffordable rental market. Also known as the Housing Choice Voucher Program, Section 8 assists households by distributing subsidies to private landlords, incentivizing them to rent their properties to qualifying low-income occupants. If participants are approved, selected, and succeed in finding an apartment or house, their local housing authority then start sending payments directly to the relevant landlord. Despite being touted as the major program to support renters, these housing vouchers are only intended to assist those classified as extremely low income. And even amongst this bracket, less than a quarter actually receives support. Before the pandemic tipped the US economy into an unprecedented recession, Section 8 assistance was being administered to around 2.5 of the 11.8 million people deemed extremely low income. Underfunded and flooded with demand, a report by the National Low Income Housing Coalition in August of 2019 revealed that the median wait for a tenant on the list for housing vouchers was around 1.5 years, with some people waiting over 7 years to receive support. The same report also found that over half of all local waiting lists had been closed to new applicants. As of March this year, only 36 affordable and available homes exist for every 100 extremely low-income renter households. While Section 8 vouchers are failing to provide affordable rents on an adequate scale, the system for actually constructing new low-income housing units has been consistently outsourced to the private sector. Since the welfare reforms of Bill Clinton's second term, the Faircloth Amendment has limited the total number of government-owned public housing units by law to its 1999 level. Instead, dilapidated public housing has been demolished via the HOPE 6 program and sold off to private developers through the more recent rental assistance demonstration. With only 2 million units of legacy public housing remaining, in a country of 330 million people, successive administrations have turned to government subsidies to incentivize low-income construction in the private sector. In this regard, Reagan's system of low-income housing tax credits remains the dominant policy, encouraging banks and investors to build affordable housing through billions of dollars doled out in financial aid. This dependence on private partners has proven radically insufficient. In 2017, federal tax credits provided just $8 billion across the country as a whole, nowhere near enough to make a significant contribution to the housing market. Even as demand for housing has intensified, the number of new units actually created under the LIHTC scheme has fallen from over 70,000 per year in 1997 to less than 60,000 by 2014. Over the same period, the public cost of the program has increased by 66%. With the federal government's ability to expand public housing blocked by law, the low-income housing tax credit program has become an egregious corporate giveaway to select housing developers via an extensive network of DC lobbyists. Whether it's the Section 8 program attempting to stabilize unaffordable market rate rents, or the LIHTC scheme funding major developers, the neoliberal policies deployed by successive administrations have consistently failed to address the dire crisis in U.S. housing.
This is Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. We're broadcasting from the epicenter of the coronavirus pandemic in the United States, New York City. Here in New York State, the death toll has surpassed 1,000 with more than 60,000 cases. So, of course, that is a serious underestimate because of the lack of access we have to tests. In New York City, which accounts for more than half the state's cases, sirens can be heard wailing around the clock as New York scrambles to treat the growing number of critically ill patients. But as New Yorkers and people around the world are told to stay at home to prevent the spread of the virus, tens of thousands of unhoused people here in New York City shelters and on the streets have been left with no way to safely shelter in place. The virus is also spreading through the city's shelter system, where at least 70 cases have been reported in 45 shelters. People have died.
Despite President Trump's initial attempts to downplay the virus, it became evident through the early months of 2020 that the United States faced both a public health crisis and a crippling economic collapse. With the World Health Organization formally announcing COVID-19 as a worldwide pandemic at the beginning of March, Congress rushed to pass two early bills to combat the spread of the virus. On March 6, the day that worldwide cases surpassed 100,000, Trump signed into law an $8 billion bill, including $3 billion for private healthcare companies to conduct vaccine research. 5 days later, the Families First Coronavirus Response Act was introduced in the House, providing funding for paid sick leave, increased Medicaid, and free COVID testing, as well as expanding food assistance and unemployment benefits.
Senate Democratic Leader Schumer and I, last weekend, called for further action to put families first. Today, we are passing a bill that does just that, the Families First Coronavirus Response Act, which is focused directly on providing support for America's families, who must be our first priority. The three most important parts of this bill are testing, testing, testing. This legislation facilitates free coronavirus testing for everyone who needs a test, including the uninsured. We can only defeat this outbreak if we have an accurate determination of its scale and scope so that we can pursue the precise, science-based response that is necessary.
On March 25th, with the U.S. becoming the epicenter of the pandemic worldwide, Congress reached a bipartisan agreement to sanction the largest stimulus package in American history. The Coronavirus Aid, Relief, and Economic Security Act included $300 billion in one-time cash payments to individuals and an additional $260 billion in unemployment relief. It also created the Paycheck Protection Program, providing forgivable loans to small businesses and setting aside a $500 billion fund for large corporations. With the U.S. housing system already in a state of emergency, the CARES Act also allocated money for the Department of Housing and Urban Development in an attempt to assuage an unprecedented tidal wave of evictions. A moratorium on foreclosures for those with federally backed mortgages was introduced, alongside a short-term eviction ban covering the roughly 28% of renters in federally assisted homes. In addition, CARES also gave those with federally backed home loans the right to request forbearance, deferring or reducing payments for up to a maximum of 180 days.
It is imperative that we address the needs of the American people with clarity on how we proceed. That is why today, House Democrats are introducing the HEROES Act, named for our heroes, whose provisions are largely based on the four previous bipartisan bills we have passed. The HEROES Act focuses on three pillars: opening our economy safely and soon, honoring our heroes, and then putting much-needed money into the pockets of the American people. We can all agree that we must open our economy as quickly as we can, but we must do so based on science and data. The key to opening the door is testing, tracing, treatment, and social distancing. And we must do so in a way that reaches all Americans, in a way that addresses the disparities we have seen, so that we can assess the full extent of the coronavirus and defeat it.
With the ban on mortgage evictions lifting at the end of August, and the moratorium on federally assisted rental homes already expired, Congress has since stalled over the introduction of new measures. In May, the Democrat-controlled House of Representatives passed its own legislation, the Health and Economic Recovery Omnibus Emergency Solutions Act, HEROES, which set out the potential expansion of existing moratoriums, extending them for up to a year and widening the bracket to include all renters and homeowners. Denounced by Republicans as unrealistic, and by many progressive Democrats as insufficient, the $3 trillion HEROES Act was killed in the Senate under the auspices of Majority Leader Mitch McConnell and President Trump. Now, with the Senate adjourned in a pro forma session until Labor Day on September 7th, there is little immediate chance for relief for desperate tenants in an increasingly precarious market. The $600 weekly unemployment checks provided under the CARES Act ended on July 31st. And as over 30 million people on jobless benefits now await new, reduced assistance via executive order, the threat of mass evictions is mounting. while America's wealthiest 12 individuals have increased their wealth by over $283 billion since the start of the COVID outbreak, millions of people are struggling to make ends meet. And as nearly 80% of hotel rooms lie empty across the country, half of all U.S. renters now face the immediate threat of homelessness.
All across the country, from Los Angeles, Philadelphia to New York, tens of thousands of tenants banded together in the largest coordinated rent strike in decades.
I know a lot of families who couldn't pay the rent on April 1st, and now they're on their second month.
Frustration and fear mounting for essential workers whose jobs have become more critical during the coronavirus pandemic. Employees staged sick outs Friday, coinciding with International Workers' Day, calling out companies like Target.
As America is plunged into the worst economic and eviction crisis since the Great Depression, there has been a resurgence of grassroots activism demanding a systemic overhaul of federal housing policy. Following decades of government programs that intentionally prevented the renovation and erection of public housing, grassroots activists and their political allies have increasingly located the commodification of housing for profit at the heart of the current crisis. In the wake of the 2008 financial crash, international social movements such as Occupy introduced wealth inequality and structural critiques of our economic system into the political discourse. Daniel Cohen, an assistant professor of sociology at the University of Pennsylvania and co-author of the book A Planet to Win: Why We Need a Green New Deal, explains how these movements demonstrate a clear response to material insecurity and inequality in urban centers.
You know, you have Occupy Wall Street, you have the Arab Spring, you have the Gezi Park uprising in Turkey. You have, so 2 or 3 years of what we talk about the movement of the squares. And in many ways, they're revolts against inequality and the declining quality of life in urban spaces that bring together kind of broad tent of what outside of the US and Latin America and elsewhere, we think of the popular classes. And I think it would be correct to see these as protests against financialization, protests against increases in the cost of living, and movements for a kind of more egalitarian, higher quality of life, a more collective well-being in urban spaces. These are profoundly urban movements. This made a huge impression at the time. The Economist Intelligence Unit released a report saying that these protests were systematically diminishing the quality of life in the world's biggest cities, which I think these movements can take as a badge of honor. And, you know, that cycle of protest ended, but the underlying conditions, which is really driven by the financialization of housing and of urban land, which makes it impossible to have sufficient park space, sufficient social care, sufficient housing, those underlying conditions didn't change. And so now I think what you see with this new wave of urban explosions is the politics are somewhat different because it's been 5 years, but I think fundamentally the demands are very similar. I mean, if you look at what sparks Gezi Park, the destruction of a park, you look at Chile, 30 cents too many, that looks a lot like the bus protests in Brazil, although in Chile with an even more progressive character right now. I think what you see is that the movement of squares confined to 2 or 3 years was wrong. There are just moments of greater and lesser intensity in the struggle for common space in cities.
As the banks that practiced criminal behavior and foreclosed on millions of Americans were bailed out, the burgeoning populist rage became directed not just at an unfettered capitalist system, but at the political insiders pushing corporate interests, especially those with close ties to the real estate industry. Speaking directly to grassroots movements on the ground, progressive candidates refusing corporate PAC money have been competing in local and national elections, running on platforms that explicitly call for transformative changes to housing policy. We spoke to Samelis Lopez, a Bronx housing activist with the Democratic Socialists of America and former congressional candidate in New York's 15th district.
There's a national crisis on homelessness. Specifically in New York State alone, there are a lot of children that are homeless and they're struggling with these issues. And I think it should be given that platform because there's a lot of predatory tendencies in the real estate developer community. And we basically need to decommodify this whole system. And I think one of the conversations that needs to be had that we're having on our campaign is the importance of taking big money out of politics and challenging people that are running for office and challenging them to say, if you are running a race that's for the community, like, you're not going to accept certain kinds of donations. And right now in this race in particular, there's a lot of corporate Democrats that are taking huge sums of money from real estate developers, from the pharmaceutical industry, from corporate PACs. So it's a time to put an end to that, because this congressional district is experiencing a very dire gentrification and a displacement crisis that's threatening to clean out this borough. And we can't allow that. And we have to challenge that connection. And it's not only one candidate that's taking this money. It's many different corporate elected officials, Democratic elected officials running in this race that either have had histories of taking this money in the past or are taking that kind of money now. And, you know, we need to basically fundraise in a way that centers the needs and the values and the perspectives that directly impact the communities. And that's not it. We need to put the community first, not the donors.
Another member of DSA and prominent figurehead of the housing activist movement is the current New York State Senator, Julia Salazar. In 2018, Salazar prioritized guaranteeing affordable housing for all in her campaign for office, focusing in particular on policies to expand state rent control.
There are some on the left who, in this national political moment, will say that we can only make minimal demands, that we need to compromise our values and our vision in order to be effective. But as socialists, we don't buy that. We don't buy that because we don't operate with a vision of scarcity. We operate with a vision of abundance. We know that when people's rights are under attack, we need to be making maximalist demands. That's why I support universal rent control.
In the wake of these recent local successes, activists are pushing for rent control to be adopted on the federal level. Currently, 36 states preempt local governments from adopting rent regulation laws. And as of 2019, only 5 states and the District of Columbia have localities in which some form of residential rent control is in effect. If adopted nationwide, 42 million households could see their rents stabilized.
Oh, absolutely. I think that we need a national rent control, and we also need to explore national commercial rent control too, to preserve the small businesses in our community. So I'm definitely on board, and that's a key element of the Homes Guarantee platform as well. I'm grateful to the leadership of people like Julia Salazar that she held herself accountable to a movement, because the rent regulations that were passed this spring was a movement, an activist on the ground that got together and mobilized and made countless trips to Albany to make their voices heard. And it was people like Julia Salazar that were part of this new progressive political class of New York State senators that paved that path. So it demonstrated that when you have a movement on the ground that's supported by the right political environment, there's no telling what we can do together as a community. And that was an example of how, when politics meets a movement, what can happen.
Whilst an important component in addressing America's housing affordability crisis, rent control does not solve the basic issue of undersupply. In the face of this reality, many locally elected officials have focused on raising funds for municipal governments to address the homelessness crisis by taxing the wealthiest members in their community. Kashama Sawant, a socialist member of the Seattle City Council, was first elected in 2013 on a mandate to tax the city's largest corporations, such as Amazon, to expand affordable housing.
We recognize that Seattle has been the construction crane capital of the country 4 years running. In other words, construction is booming. You can't walk a few blocks without running into those, you know, giant cranes. But at the same time, housing has become less affordable and rents have skyrocketed, which in other words shows you how the capitalist for-profit market system does not build for affordability. It builds to maximize profits at the top. So we need an alternative to the for-profit market in the first place. That's why we want to, we have put forward a proposal to raise $300 million every year by taxing just the largest 3% of corporations. So, it, you know, 97% of the small and medium-sized businesses, none of them is going to pay. Nonprofits will not be paying. Government employers will not be paying. But only the wealthiest corporations. In other words, it's the wealthiest people that will be paying so that we can raise $300 million per year so that we can address seriously the homelessness crisis, start building green-built, union-built social housing. And also, some of those funds will be reserved for the Green New Deal.
Following activist politicians like Salazar in New York and Sawant in Seattle, DSA and other progressive organizations have endorsed a slate of candidates in the 2020 Democratic primary cycle. Running on platforms that explicitly critique the real estate lobby, these candidates are championing a bold new agenda for federal and local housing policy, the Homes Guarantee.
Right now, it's almost impossible to imagine a different way, to imagine that we wouldn't have to stress about paying rent. But there is another way, and we have imagined it. Our vision? A Homes Guarantee. It's simple. In the richest country in the history of the world, we can and we must guarantee that everyone has safe, accessible, sustainable, and permanently affordable housing. We need major action that addresses the severity of the crisis. We need a Homes Guarantee that will build 12 million social housing units and end homelessness, reinvest in public housing, protect tenants, and decommodify housing altogether, prioritizing people over profit. A Homes Guarantee will provide restorative justice and jobs in communities impacted by racist housing policy. It can help us fight climate change by slashing carbon emissions and supporting sustainability in our homes. A Homes Guarantee sounds radical. It's not. We can and we must guarantee homes for everyone. A Homes Guarantee is urgently needed, morally right, and politically smart. Join us. We're going to need your support.
The Homes Guarantee begins with the simple premise that housing is a human right. Launched by People's Action, a national network of grassroots organizations, the Homes Guarantee was constructed by a team of 100 people who are directly impacted from the housing crisis. As the official policy brief states, the private market has failed to meet the needs of the people, as have the government interventions pursued to date. In a departure from the neoliberal desire to privatize public goods, the movement is demanding that social housing be permanently off the private speculative housing market. On a scale not seen since the original New Deal, the Homes Guarantee calls for building 12 million social housing units over the next 10 years and reinvesting $30 billion annually over 5 years to repair crumbling housing stock. Peter Gowan, a researcher at the Democracy Collaborative and policy advisor to the Homes Guarantee program, explains how the growing Homes Guarantee movement is organizing to influence mainstream political debate in Washington.
So I think that it's going to take the emergence of a mass social movement of workers and tenants fighting against the exploitation which exists in the housing market. It's not going to come out of one president alone. It's not going to come out of one candidate, certainly alone. If a president gets elected on a transformative platform and they don't have a movement behind them that's willing to back them up and to organize on a local, on a state, on a federal level for the kinds of things that we need to see, then we're not going to get the kind of change even if the people voted for it. But if you do have this kind of mass movement, I think that the scale of the exploitation and the scale of the crisis provides an opportunity for a president to really be able to mobilize their supporters and to mobilize the people who are being affected by this crisis to fight back. And that's going to involve things like creating tenants unions on the citywide basis who can organize, push back directly against the corporate landlords and developers in their city, but also to mobilize people to push for political changes. It's going to involve people organizing on a national level to pressure their senators and representatives to vote for the kind of legislation that we need to see. And it's going to involve generally a higher level of political consciousness among people of the roots of this crisis in the profit motive in the housing market. And if we're able to educate and organize people for that, then there's really no limits to what we can achieve.
The impact of this movement is already becoming evident in DC, particularly amongst the leading figures of the progressive movement in Congress. Representative Ilhan Omar has been one of the staunchest allies of the Homes Guarantee. In November of 2019, Omar introduced a Homes for All Act, which would construct 12 million units of social housing. The act repeals the Faircloth Amendment, which has disallowed federal government investment in new public housing since the late 1990s.
One of the first things I noticed when I came to the United States were people sleeping on the side of the streets. And I have been on a mission ever since to make sure that there are no humans left in that situation. Today, I'm excited to introduce the Homes for All Act, which will fulfill the promise of a homes guarantee by building 12 million new public housing and private, permanently affordable rental units, fastly expanding the available affordable housing stock, driving down costs throughout the market, and creating a new vision of what public housing looks like in the United States of America.
In addition to focusing on building millions of units of public housing, Omar's bill in the Homes Guarantee recognizes the climate crisis as the greatest displacement threat. Another newly elected member of Congress, Representative Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, has built upon the momentum of People's Action, proposing massive public investment in social housing in line with the Homes Guarantee and the Green New Deal. In the first piece of legislation proposed following the Green New Deal resolution, Representative Ocasio-Cortez and Senator Bernie Sanders co-sponsored a Green New Deal for public housing.
It adopts the tenets of the Green New Deal, which is first to center frontline communities, those who are impacted most by the climate crisis. That is communities that are low income, communities that are communities of color, native communities, rural communities. We're going to center them, and that's why we've decided to go with public housing first.
The bill aims to commit $172 billion over 10 years to upgrade and retrofit 1.2 million federally administered homes. Prioritizing frontline and minority communities, the bill addresses systemic environmental racism and the housing crisis. As the legislation notes, buildings have a tremendous carbon footprint, responsible for over one-third of carbon emissions in the U.S. Daniel Cohen, a key proponent of the Green New Deal for public housing, outlines his vision for social housing within the context of a zero-carbon equitable society in his recent book on the Green New Deal.
So if you're thinking, okay, what are we trying to do here in terms of the built environment, is we're trying to create physical landscapes, broadly understood, which enable public affluence. We're trying to kind of rebuild physically a world in which you can walk to the childcare center where your child is. You can walk to work or take the bus or ride a bike, feasibly. We want to make cities that have like really serious public recreation amenities in them. We haven't had a massive burst of public recreation construction since the original New Deal. We want to have more of that, and we want to have the possibility of wild spaces beyond cities that people can access in a no carbon way. And at the very center of this vision of kind of no carbon landscapes of public affluence is housing. Because this, our vision of social housing is that social housing includes some essential services. It is physically located close to other desirable parts of the city, jobs, recreation, social services, and so on. It absolutely decommodifies the bare necessity of life. So instead of having to work hours and hours and hours to pay for your housing, that housing is at extremely low cost. And if you don't have income, you know, it's free. And I think that housing kind of incarnates a vision of the world, which is a density of freedoms. And your home is the kind of foundation of a really free relationship to the rest of the world.
There is precedent, both internationally and domestically, outlining tangible ways that public housing can be constructed in a way that is not stigmatized, but applauded as temples of public luxury. One of the leading inspirations for this model comes from Red Vienna. Under the Social Democratic-led municipal government in power since the Second World War, the city has invested heavily in public infrastructure. As part of this project, social housing complexes were built that were designed as more than just shelter. They included childcare centers, nursing homes, libraries, schools, gyms, pools, and cultural programs. Today, Vienna hosts some of the nicest public housing in the world, enjoyed by the majority of its residents. 3 in 5 people reside in homes owned, built, or managed by the municipal government, and those participating in the private housing market are protected from exorbitant rates through locally enforced rent caps.
So to get a bit more detailed on housing, you know, you compare different models. You look at the U.S. model of public housing because of the legislation in 1937. I think it's the Wagner Act. Basically, in the U.S., it is by law illegal to build public housing that would compete with middle-class housing. I mean, it is really legislatively designed, and this was a defeat for the housing movement in the 1930s, a defeat for the left, a victory of the right. Public housing is like last resort housing that makes it very easy to stigmatize, to confine the most stigmatized people to that housing and to never even keep it up. It actually had really great potential, but it was treated very badly. And the alternative vision is a vision that you have in Vienna, but you have in other parts of Europe as well, which is that social housing is fantastic housing, a temple of public luxury. And in places that have done that, like in Vienna, or where you're now seeing retrofits of public housing in that spirit in places like France, you have really beautiful housing, extreme energy efficiency, it's very healthy, and it actually advances the technological frontier of housing development in general. And even now in the US, you're starting to see, and in New York, you're starting to see that who is really pushing the frontier of multifamily passive house development are affordable housing developers, because it saves money in the long term, and because this is something that's very exciting to people. So we can have way more of that. We can use the social housing construction to augment the skills of workers and to develop the technology for no carbon luxury for everybody.
Other notable examples cited by those proposing a bold social housing agenda in the US use the Swedish model to outline what is possible. In the 1960s, Sweden was facing a severe housing shortage. In the middle of the decade, the Social Democratic government outlined an audacious goal, building 1 million new homes in a decade. This was an ambitious task, as the existing housing stock consisted of 3 million units in the entire country. Financed by the state via city-owned housing authorities and housing cooperatives, the Swedish Million Homes program succeeded in reaching its intended goal.
Drawing inspiration from these historic successes abroad and Roosevelt's New Deal at home, the new movement for a homes guarantee and a Green New Deal has tabled a set of radical policies that are beginning to influence mainstream political debate in Washington, D.C. These demands have become a central policy pillar of housing activists on the street and insurgent progressive candidates in the 2020 election cycle. Peter Gowan explains how the growing movement has influenced the political discourse over housing policy during the 2020 presidential cycle.
One that I've really been excited by is Bernie Sanders, who has endorsed the principles of a homes guarantee, which is a campaign that has seen a lot of support from candidates down the ballot, but also was developed by the People's Action Network around housing. A lot of tenants' unions, community organizations around the country had their leaders come together and develop principles for how to decommodify, stabilize, and address the core issues around housing in this country. And the Bernie Sanders campaign's plan endorses the principles. It doesn't endorse every single one of the specific measures that were in the policy document that myself and a bunch of other people produced in close collaboration with those grassroots leaders, but it does endorse the basic principles of it, and we're happy to have them on board that train.
It is clear to me, therefore,
that in the midst of this national housing emergency, we need federal policy which protects tenants from the greed we are currently seeing in the real estate industry. Under my plan, we will establish a national rent control standard, capping annual rent increases throughout the country at no more than 1.5 times the rate of inflation, or 3%, whichever is higher. Additionally, we need to allow cities and states to go even further to protect tenants from the skyrocketing price of housing. Landlords in Nevada, Vermont, and all over this country should not be able to simply raise rents to any level they want, any time they want. We're going to put an end to that.
During the 2020 Democratic primary, Senator Bernie Sanders released one of the boldest housing plans ever by a presidential candidate. Taking direct inspiration from the Homes Guarantee platform, Sanders called for an investment of $2.5 trillion to build 10 million affordable housing units, enact a national rent control standard, and end homelessness. Also in line with the Homes Guarantee and its National Tenant Bill of Rights, Sanders' plan set to limit rent increases to 1.5 times the Consumer Price Index, or 3%, whichever was lower. This platform garnered significant popular support, and combined with a resurgence of tenant activism, has helped shift the political discourse on housing in the progressive wing of the Democratic Party. The last presidential primary candidate to actually release a plan for housing was the now Democratic nominee, Joe Biden, who revealed his agenda shortly before the South Carolina primary. Extending the policies of the Obama administration, Biden's approach to affordable housing returns to many of the central tenets of the neoliberal era. Alongside an expansion of the LIHTC and community development block grants, Biden's platform lays out a vision for fully funding Section 8, ensuring that every eligible extremely low-income individual receives a voucher, and none pay more than 30% of their income in rent. It also proposes a new renter's tax credit to cover rent and utility costs over 30% of income for families that make too much money to qualify for Section 8, and creates a permanent refundable $15,000 tax credit to help first-time home buyers make a down payment on a house.
What are you going to do as president?
Well, I'm going to make sure that everyone qualifies for Section 8 housing. No one should pay more than 30% of their income to be able to have rent. I'm going to make sure first-time home buyers are able to get a $15,000 down payment in federal government. I'm going to see to it that we invest an awful lot of money in providing housing and providing, in addition to housing, I had a long talk with Mayor Garcetti today about that very issue, laying out our mutual housing plan. We have to invest a great deal of money. Housing should be a right for people. The idea that you have so many people on the street in California because of the increase in cost of housing, it's just not right. And we're going to fully fund housing, and we're going to make sure that everyone has access to Section 8 housing. No one should pay more than 30% of their income for housing.
In a pivot towards the popularity of the Green New Deal, Biden's plan also directs $10 billion for energy efficiency retrofits to existing affordable housing, and pursues equitable zoning to make Americans' homes and transportation choices more affordable and less carbon intensive. But while policies such as extending housing vouchers and a renter's tax credit do provide significant housing market stabilizers, Biden's housing agenda does not consider an expansion of rent control, nor does it address the fundamental undersupply of affordable units. In his official policy brief, there is no mention of repealing the Faircloth Amendment or expanding US public housing stock. At its core, Biden's plan falls back on updating the existing policy frameworks, utilizing the tax credits and market nudges typical of the neoliberal era, and continuing to outsource the responsibility for affordable housing to the private sector. In this way, the Democratic Party establishment remains a far cry from demands of tenant activists and the growing movements on the ground.
They said staying home would save lives, but you can't stay home if you don't have one. My name is Zahran Kwame Mamdani, and that was my family's story. In 1972, they were evicted and expelled from their home in Uganda because of the color of their skin. We immigrated to this city when I was 7, and today I work as a foreclosure prevention counselor.
I'm here to talk today about the housing crisis across our state.
All across Queens, I see the pain my family felt then in the faces of my clients now. Immigrant families forced to choose between their hospital bills and their mortgage, feeding their kids or keeping the lights on. Yet while my clients struggle, luxury developers continue to determine who deserves to live in Astoria. And if you're not getting priced out, you're getting pushed out.
Within the context of the current coronavirus pandemic and a potential wave of mass evictions, the movements pushing for systemic changes to housing policy have seen major electoral successes in down-ballot elections across the country. In cities hardest hit by the virus, such as New York, champions of the Homes Guarantee and the Green New Deal have been elected to both the state legislature and congressional seats. With Biden and the Democratic establishment returning to the market-based policies of the neoliberal era, these activist politicians now represent the best hope for those on the front lines of the crisis. In demanding a break with the failing policies that have marked successive bipartisan administrations, popular movements have created an opening for radical change. In the next episode, in our series on the U.S. election, we'll examine how many of these movements calling for housing as a human right are extending their bold economic agenda to the education sector, tabling new demands that are shifting the policy framework in the context of the 2020 U.S. election.
Thank you for listening to this Our Voices podcast from Open Democracy. If you enjoyed this podcast and would encourage others to listen, head to iTunes, subscribe, and leave us a review. Open Democracy is an independent global media platform that is only possible because of your kind donations. To find out more or to make a donation, head to opendemocracy.net.